This program is a production of WAMC News. From Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly half-hour review of New York State government and politics. Your host is political scientist and syndicated columnist Dr. Alan Shartok of the State University.
In this edition of the Legislative Gazette, we'll explore the controversial issue of changing the grand jury system in New York State. We'll also have a report card on the bottle bill and a budget update. As of airtime late Friday, the governor and legislative leaders were still working on the budget, which is supposed to be in place by Monday. Bill Gralty has the latest.
I think we are on the verge of adopting a budget that is extraordinarily good for the people of the state.
That was early Friday morning, Governor Cuomo emerging from a late bargaining session, sounding at last somewhat confident about reaching budget agreement. For days, he and Speaker Fink had been at loggerheads with Senate Majority Leader Warren Anderson over the fate of four special taxes. Ultimately, Anderson agreed to allow the taxes to stay on the books. There'll be a $550 million income tax cut, a $100 million cut in motor vehicle registration fees, and a $70 million reduction in taxes on in-state phone calls. Although that somewhat complex agreement allows the budget to go forward, the governor says the budget is not signed, sealed, and delivered.
There's still a lot that has to be done. We don't have agreement on the education aid formula or local assistance. We don't have agreement on many items, but none of them present insuperable problems. I think the log jam has now broken.
As talks continued late Friday, a spokesman for Assembly Speaker Fink was saying it was doubtful an actual vote on the budget could come before Monday, April 1st, the deadline for having the new budget in place, and yet still anything is possible. This is Bill Gralty.
Joining us now is Dr. Lee Marengoff. He's the director of the Institute for Public Opinion at Marist College and our resident expert on public opinion polls.
The New York State budget has attracted its share of headlines this past week as the April 1st deadline approaches. Attention has centered on the key actors, the governor, Majority Leader Anderson, and Speaker Fink. Will they each give a little to form a compromise? Who will bend the most? What will we learn about the political skill of each politician? These are the types of questions that budget time in Albany brings out. The ups and downs of political careers are important, and there is a place, I'm sure, for discussion about how Governor Cuomo handles or fails to handle Fink and Anderson and others. But we need also to remember that budgets determine much more than winners and losers among the politicians careening around the corridors of the state capitol. Budget considerations reflect the priorities of decision makers and presumably the constituents they represent. What to do with a budget surplus is just such a vital issue. Clearly, the decision has been made to eliminate or reduce certain taxes, but how much and which ones? It is equally important to recognize that the extra cash presently on hand provides the opportunity to establish programs to aid individuals in need. But how much of a surplus do you return in tax breaks, and how much do you use to address problems people are enduring? The answer depends largely on the state of the economy and the well-being of the people. The perception around the corridors in Albany these days, and among the citizens throughout the state, that we're enjoying a major economic recovery. And there certainly is truth to that. Unemployment is down, inflation has been lowered, and economic activity generally is up. But is everyone sharing in the economic recovery? Should decision makers think twice about what to do with a budget surplus? In a survey we did at the Marist College Institute for Public Opinion earlier this month, it was found that a substantial number of New Yorkers are not better off financially than they were last year. In fact, 19% of state residents reported they're economically worse off than they were last year. Although there is an economic recovery, our perceptions need to be revised. Not all are sharing in it. Some additional statistics support this assertion. 41% of the state residents indicate they're having difficulty meeting monthly expenses. Not surprisingly, these individuals are concentrated in the lower income groups. What this all means is that many people are having to forgo basic necessities. 1 in 4 New York State residents reported they're unable to afford clothing that was necessary for themselves or a member of their family. 20% were unable to seek medical attention they needed, and 15% were forced to go without food at some point during the past year. When we hear about all the squabbling over the budget that is occurring among the power wielders in our state government, Let us also remember that more than just a matter of dollars and cents, the well-being of millions of state residents depend upon these budget decisions. They, too, are eager to hear the results. In the meantime, for the Legislative Gazette, this is Lee Marengoff at the Marist College Institute for Public Opinion in Poughkeepsie.
This week, the Temporary Commission on Returnable Beverage Containers issued its report on the bottle bill. Rick Lepkowski has our report.
The bottle law is working. That claim was made this week by the Temporary State Commission on Returnable Beverage Containers. Chairman of the commission, Neil Golub, says that despite the inconvenience, most New Yorkers perceive the bottle law as a good law. According to commission findings, beverage container litter has been reduced 70% to 80%, while hourly employment in the state has increased by a net of 5,000 jobs as a result of the law. One of the biggest issues confronting the commission was the problem concerning handling fees and unredeemed deposits. Golub said that voting on the issue was very close, but the commission decided to recommend that handling costs for the distributor be increased from 1.5 cents to 2 cents per container.
To the extent that handling fees are included in charges made by distributors to retailers, handling costs shall be separately listed on distributors' invoices so they will not be considered product cost upon which markup is charged by the retailer.
The bottling industry has maintained that all unredeemed deposits belong to the industry to help compensate for handling costs. The recommendation for an increase in the handling fee is seen as an effort to appease the bottlers because the commission also recommended to have all unredeemed deposits turned over to the state. Golub explained that the money would be used to reimburse any third-party redemption center for handling costs over and above the 2-cent fee. Bottling industry members feel these measures of increasing handling fees and turning over unredeemed deposits will adversely affect the industry, and the final victim of these proposals will be the consumer. President of the Beverage Wholesalers Association, Al Lubrano.
The beverage industry will lose on both counts. If they have to turn over the unredeemed deposits and increase the handling fee, they're going to lose on two counts, which means that the consumer will be socked twice. Once for the increase in the handling fee and once for the unredeemed deposits, which are now being used by the beverage industry to offset other costs of the bottle law. If they lose that source of revenue, if the beverage industry loses that source of revenue, then they must go to increase prices to recover their costs, as they will have to do with the increase in the handling fee. So, if you will, it's a double whammy on the consumer.
Governor Cuomo says the unredeemed nickels belong to the people of New York State, not the bottlers, and the governor has proposed using unredeemed deposits for the cleanup of toxic waste. But legislative leaders foresee some problems with the governor's proposal and have yet to embrace the measure. This story was written and produced by Larry Lewittis. I'm Rick Lepkowski in Albany.
The Bernard Goetz case has thrust many issues into the arena of public discussion. One of these is the role of the grand jury in New York's criminal justice system. As you'll recall, Goetz admitted shooting 4 youths on a New York City subway after they allegedly threatened him. He appeared before 2 grand juries. The first indicted him only on weapons charges. But this week, a second grand jury heard new evidence and chose to indict Goetz on charges of attempted murder, reckless endangerment, and weapons violations. The Goetz case may have put the grand jury into the public limelight, but even before everyone knew who Bernie Goetz was, the issue of reforming the grand jury system was under consideration. We're going to discuss that and other related issues, but first, a background report from Bill Gralty.
The grand jury is deeply rooted in common law. In theory, its function is to prevent authorities from arbitrarily charging people with crimes. The state must appear before the grand jury and present evidence as to why a person should be charged. The grand jury then weighs the evidence and testimony and decides whether or not to indict. Well, that's how it works in theory. In fact, some people are now alleging that grand juries have become tools of district attorneys who, they argue, have too much control and influence in the grand jury room. Legislation has been filed by Assemblyman Ralph Goldstein to sharply cut back on the use of grand juries, replacing them in most cases with preliminary hearings before a judge who would then decide if there is sufficient evidence to put a person on trial.
Let the DA bring on a complaint before a judge of the court, who will then decide two issues. One, has a crime been committed? Two, is there reason to believe that this defendant that's charged committed it?
One argument against the grand jury system, heard from such disparate legal sources as Bernard Goetz's defense attorney and the chief judge of the Court of Appeals, is that with the power they now have, district attorneys can get grand juries to indict a ham sandwich.
You can indict a ham sandwich, as Judge Wackler said. Well, this is all well and good, except it's a protection for the individual. The alternative, of course, would be the district attorney makes his mind up and says this person will be charged with a felony. So it works.
That's Assemblyman Arnold Proskin. His resume lists lawyer, district attorney, judge, and now assemblyman. Not only does he argue that the grand jury system works, he refutes another common criticism that in America today, when a person is indicted, the public, for all intents and purposes, considers him to be guilty, the constitutional guarantee of innocent until proven guilty notwithstanding. Proskin argues that the alternatives would be no better.
If you didn't have a grand jury system, and some district attorney said, Arnold Proskin, or Joe Blow, or Sam Smith, I'm going to charge him with a crime. What difference is it? I mean, at least with the grand jury, you have 23 people who sit and listen to evidence and make a determination as to whether the person should be charged. It's an effective tool for defense attorneys. Not effective. It's another tool for defense attorneys because this testimony, the person had to go before that grand jury and say, yes, I saw this, I did this, and this is what happened. And this is one other time he's testified, and you could test his credibility later on in case he changed his mind.
Another problem cited by opponents of the grand jury system is the ability of the prosecution to grant immunity, that is, allowing witnesses to testify before the grand jury with no fear of later being charged with the crimes about which they're talking. Assemblyman Goldstein says this practice can lead to abuse, and his proposal for pretrial hearings instead of grand juries deals with that issue as well.
Invite the people in, even subpoena them in, they would come before the court. Now, he doesn't. The DA does not have to give immunity. He just subpoenas witnesses, same as he would on a trial. Now someone gets on the stand, they don't want to testify. They will now say to the court, I refuse to testify on the grounds that it may tend to incriminate me. The court will then determine whether or not that Fifth Amendment privilege should be sustained. If it is, he doesn't have to testify. If it isn't, he can be made to testify. There's no more an immunity problem. It disappears. So you should say, gee, why don't the DAs like it then? That would be great. Well, because the ability to grant immunity is power.
Assemblyman Ralph Goldstein. I'm Bill Grawley.
Now, with that in mind, we'll hear from a man who is on the firing line with grand juries on a regular basis, Albany County District Attorney Saul Greenberg, who comments on grand juries and other issues.
Mr. Greenberg, Assemblyman Goldstein says he wants to do away with grand juries. You think that's a bad idea. Why?
Well, I think that the grand jury system right now, which has been operable in this country for over 200 years, operates very well. And why change it if it's operating well? I see nothing wrong with it. I think, unfortunately, what's happened is that there's been a perception created in the minds of the public, particularly through the print press, that there's something mysterious about the grand jury and that the inference is that district attorneys abuse their power before the grand jury.
Now, I know you're going to say to me that district attorneys have no business and shouldn't abuse their power and get people indicted because they still have to face a regular jury. And if they have a weak case and they've shoved it through the grand jury, that it doesn't make any sense. Is that right?
That's wrong because of this reason. We like the grand jury to make that preliminary determination on our presentation of legally sufficient facts to show probable cause that a crime is committed and the defendant named is the one who committed the crime. Now, unfortunately, what's happened is there are certain cases we put before the grand jury that are basically weak cases. But these are cases that are put there because these defendants have been up to the water trough once too often. They've been given a lot of opportunities in the past. Mm-hmm. That the judges in the lower courts, where they have been charged with felonies, want them sent up to the superior court before which court you present to the grand juries. We occasionally have to do that. Also, a grand jury's presentation by the district attorney, who is the advisor to the grand juries, has to put in testimony, and a transcript is made of every word said and typed up almost immediately after the hearings, and subject to judicial review, so that there is a check and balance upon the district attorney's performance before the grand jury.
So you're telling me that if that the minutes of the grand jury will eventually get before a judge, and the judge will be able to review that and see if anything improper has gone on for the district by the district attorney, right?
That is correct. As a matter of fact, I've been in office over 10 years, and I would say that not more than a half a dozen indictments have been thrown out because of the lack of sufficient legal evidence before a grand jury.
Now, does the judge actually get an opportunity? That's a bad word. Does the judge actually sit down and read each of these grand jury proceedings? Seems to me that's an awful lot of verbiage.
That's true, but where the defense lawyer makes a so-called omnibus motion, he will claim that there are not legally sufficient facts before the grand jury, and he demands a review of the grand jury minutes, which judges do. It's part of their function.
Now, Assemblyman Goldstein says that essentially our law is adversarial. You have a prosecutor who brings a charge, you have a defense attorney who defends that charge. That's the way it is in a regular trial. Except in the grand jury, it isn't that way. Because in the grand jury, says Goldstein, the district attorney not only brings the charge, but also acts essentially as the judge overseeing the proceeding. In other words, he gets to determine which evidence is brought, who gets asked which question. And that stops it from being adversarial. It's like giving all the power to the district attorney.
Well, we're bound by the rules of law, you know, with respect to the matters we present. Where, for instance, that would be a case where you need corroboration, where there's an accomplice put in there, a person who becomes a so-called state's witness, who may have been a participant in a crime, but we feel that he was a lesser participant, and we can use his testimony. His testimony alone is not sufficient, so that even before the grand jury, where you have accomplished testimony, you must have independent corroboration right before the grand jury, so that we are bound by the rules, as you would be at a trial, except that a grand jury presentation is not a regular trial. We do not have to put in all the witnesses, all of our evidence. All we have to present is legally sufficient evidence to show probable cause the crime is committed, the defendant committed the crime. See, the great problem with respect to the grand jury is because it's a secret proceeding, and I'll get into why it's secret in a minute if you'll permit me that. Therefore, it's suspect of being corrupt. It creates a suspicion, and the print media particularly has just capitalized on that suspicion. Because they basically, most media tend to be suspicious of public officials anyway.
Okay, you said secrecy is something that sticks in their craw. The Constitution of the United States calls for open trials. Now, when I'm indicted before a grand jury, right, my mother-in-law slams the door in my face, I lose my job. There's a lot of negative things that happen if somebody is indicted. So that it's not this sort of neutral and harmless thing that happens. You really are going to suffer if you're indicted.
No doubt about the fact that the power given to a DA is awesome. And I think that the DA is aware of that. At least most DAs I know are aware of that. Consequently, we don't go in before a grand jury on a vengeful thing, for a vengeful reason. We realize the onus created when a person is indicted despite the fact he or she may be acquitted at a trial. We're aware of that. You know, the defendants have a right to go before the grand jury. As a matter of fact, under the law, they're given notice of grand jury proceedings and they're invited to come forward. Why is it that 98.3% of the defendants never appear before the grand jury? Because, you know, as a matter of fact, they're guilty of what they've been charged with or some element of that crime. But the law says that you're deemed innocent until proven guilty, and the burden's upon the people to prove this case beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, the reason for the secrecy is very interesting. Twofold, basically. One, proceedings are secret in order to induce people as witnesses to come forward without fear of reprisal. Now, the press were there, and they said that John Doe said this about John Schmoe. John Schmoe is going to go after John Doe when he comes out. But a person appearing before the grand jury does not have to reveal to anybody outside that grand jury room as to what he or she said. Mm-hmm. So in order to induce these people to come forth and speak the truth without fear of reprisal, it's kept secret.
Where do you think this is all going on a political term? Do you suspect that this thing has any real chance of passage this year?
I hope not. Assemblyman Goldstein's been very vociferous about it for a couple of years. As a matter of fact, he and I have locked horns in a very friendly way with respect to our positions. He and I will be on a panel for the Fund for the Modern Courts in the near future, and consequently we will take opposing positions. He's a very, very vociferous individual. He's very articulate, and I hope he gives me a chance to talk. Sometimes when you're with him, he doesn't, but in a friendly way, he's a great guy. Well, that's his feeling. A lot of people feel that way. But on balance, a lot of people want to eliminate the grand jury and never been in the grand jury themselves as prosecutors, and it's not all that bad. You know, Assemblyman Goldstein talks about the fact of mandatory preliminary hearings. Let's get down to one practical point here. He comes from Queens. Are you familiar with the criminal justice system in New York City and the five boroughs there?
Yes.
With the exception of Richmond, Staten Island. The other four boroughs are just rolling over in workload with respect to criminal justice system. Preliminary hearings right now are conducted in the lower courts, in your misdemeanor courts. Right now in the city of New York, if you as a defense lawyer represent a person charged with a misdemeanor offense, all you have to do is ask for a trial. Because you'll never get a trial within a statutory period of time, and then you move for dismissal for failure to get a speedy trial.
Mm-hmm.
How, if they can handle misdemeanor cases right now by the tens of thousands, are they going to be able to handle the added burden of mandatory preliminary hearings where you're talking about tens of thousands of felony charges in the course of any given year?
I know you've done a study of this. Some of those preliminary hearings can be fairly extensive.
No doubt about it. Look at California, the McMaster's case with the child abuse by by nursery operations. That's running into months now.
How long does it take you to indict somebody before a grand jury?
Oh, maybe a half hour, three-quarters of an hour, sometimes 2 hours. It depends upon the nature of the case and the seriousness of the crime. If you're talking about a homicide, you're going to bring in more witnesses. You have to have more specialized witnesses. It may take 2 hours. But I assure you, a preliminary hearing in a homicide would take days. And we got statistical reports from the DA in Los Angeles County in California who indicated that their workload has gone up tremendously because of mandatory preliminary hearings.
The district attorneys in this state are extraordinarily powerful compared to some other states, aren't they?
I think they're powerful all over. It's a very powerful job, basically, and as a matter of fact, it's awesome. I would say that next to the governor, possibly one other state official, that I, being the DA of Albany County, stands in a position maybe being one of the most powerful political figures in the state of New York.
I want to follow that up with you because I think you're right. You are essentially, if a charge is going to be brought against a public official on the state level, it's probably, and it's a state crime, it's probably Saul Greenberg that's going to have to bring it, right?
Possibly, right. And then we can investigate legislative actions. We can investigate many things. Investigate various department actions. Conduct long, embarrassing grand jury proceedings. Word gets out because there are too many people involved in these departments. They know about it, particularly when you're subpoenaing certain people from that department. That's how word gets out regarding grand jury proceedings.
And let me try to trap you, Saul, for a moment, but at least let me, as a DA, as I know you tell me I was a target, I'm going to try to identify this as a potential trap question. If you go up there lobbying for the district attorneys, and you are a guy with the kind of clout, potential clout, over the legislature, do you see the point I'm getting to, that in fact they may say, wait a second now, this is a guy I may have to deal with in another sense sometime?
No, I don't think that has any bearing with respect to what they decide to do or not to do with respect to legislation that the DA's association may propose. We've locked horns with them many, many times, and got to realize that most of the committees up there with the lawyers involved are defense lawyers, and so you have to do a lot of convincing to get them to move in certain fields. We come up there, frankly, with proposals that are based upon our experience. You know, the legislature likes to brag about the fact that they have enacted a tremendous amount of anti-crime legislation. What is anti-crime legislation? There's no such thing. You know, you and I know there's no anti-crime legislation. The fact of the matter is, if a crime is committed, it's committed. They may create laws that may enhance the ability to prosecute somebody or may act as a hurdle in the prosecution field. Mm-hmm. But there's no such thing as anti-crime legislation.
What does the DA Association want to do on the death penalty?
The DA's Association, as a matter of fact, will have a meeting very, very shortly. It's the executive committee to determine that. And as you know, the governor is interested in life without parole. The DA's Association at its January winter meeting this year in New York City took that up. It's been tabled for the time being, but there is some feeling among the DAs that if you're not going to get a death penalty, at least you might be able to get something that will bring you closer to that. Now, not all DAs are interested and support the death penalty theory. I have publicly declared that I would be interested in having a death penalty on the books to be used very, very sparingly. And of all the homicides that we've handled in Albany County since I've been DA, and I'd say we probably handle 150 of them, if I had a choice to recommend only one for the death penalty, that would be Lemuel Smith.
Albany County District Attorney Saul Greenberg. There's lots to be said about grand juries. Now you've heard from some of the top experts in the state. And in many ways, the gulf between all of them isn't that distant. They all want what's best and what's feasible. The DAs know that there's a lot wrong with the criminal justice system. One thing is the incredible crowding of the courts, especially in New York City. The district attorneys argue that to replace grand juries with a simple charge or information will result in preliminary hearings that will take on the tone of full-fledged trials. You may remember the old Perry Mason series on television. All that palaver you used to hear and see were not trials. Those were preliminary hearings. So argue the DAs, at the very moment when we need to save time in the court, we'll be constructing a whole new layer of problems which will constrict the system even more. But along come the other side who say that the grand jury system as it is now operating is just not fair. They say that our legal system is built on an adversarial basis, the defense versus the prosecution, and the idea is that the truth will out. But in the grand jury, the DA gets to present all the evidence and call the questions and question all the witnesses, as well as to grant immunity to some but not to others in order to get the ones to talk who they want to talk. But of course, it all comes down to who the DA is. Most DAs understand that getting indictments that are flimsy will end up in their potential later embarrassment in court. On the other hand, as it has been recently said, if he or she wants to, the DA can indict a ham sandwich. The recent indictment of Bernard Goetz is a case in point. When a first grand jury said no to a Goetz indictment, the DA sought a second grand jury with, quote, new information, and granting immunity from prosecution to two of the thugs who have rap sheets as long as your arm. That practice is questionable at very least, and if you haven't caught my drift, I'm questioning it. Albany County has a fine DA in the person of Saul Greenberg, a moderate and temperate man who has withstood all kinds of political pressure to follow the political winds of the moment. But New York County, otherwise known as Manhattan, well, they have a different type of DA, one who chooses to indict the ham sandwich. None of this is to build a case for Bernie Goetz, only to show that the present system could be made fairer. Maybe it's possible to save the grand jury system, but to make some adjustments. Maybe the answer is to look at the way that immunity is granted. Maybe the answer is to give the accused a little more protection before the grand jury. What we need here is goodwill and men and women working together in the interest of a fair system, which is allowed to function without strangling itself, so that those who are guilty hide behind due process to escape any punishment. Men and women of goodwill should be able to work out the needs of both sides on this important question. That's our show for this week. Join us again next week for another look at state government and politics. Bill Gralty produces and edits this program. Rick Lipkowski is associate editor. We had help this week from Larry Lewittis. Please address comments and questions to us at WAMC, Box 13000, Albany, New York, 12212. I'm Alan Chartok.
The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC News. Alan Chartok is executive producer. This program is made possible with funds provided by the State University of New York College at New Paltz.